This is Cherie Smith. It's the 21st of October, the year 2000, and I'll be interviewing Thomas Platt for the Kentucky Civil Rights Commission study on civil rights in Kentucky. Mr. Platt, first off, will you spell your first and last name so I get it correct?
Okay, first name Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S.
Okay.
Last name is Platt, P-L-A-T-T.
And what year were you born and what day were you born?
Way back. 1929.
Okay. What's your birth date?
August the 29th.
And where were you born?
Baltimore, Maryland.
You Yankee!
Yeah.
Okay. What brought you to Kentucky, to Henderson?
Well, long story. A lot of times when you're in the military, you know, they move you around overseas, around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I was overseas 13 different times, I guess.
So you were in the Army?
Army,
okay.
Yes. Major duties. Tour was in Korea. I was already in Japan during the occupation days after World War II, as I stayed before I went in 1947. And so I spent 3 years in Japan during the occupation. And then when the Korean War started in 1950, I was the first one to go. So I caught some of the heavy stuff over there. And so I was slightly wounded and sent me back to the States. And they sent me to San Francisco. I was in the hospital there for a couple of months. And then from there, they transferred me to Fisk Simmons Hospital, which is in Denver, Colorado. And as I got better, they said, well, we'll send you to another camp and put you on light duty for about 6 months. And so we're going to send you to Camp Breckenridge, Kentucky. I said, well, where is camp? I said, the only place I know in Kentucky is Louisville. So they sent me to Breckenridge, and that's how I ended up in Kentucky. And this was in 1951. And then I met my wife here. In 52, we got married in 53. Working on 48 years of marriage now.
Wow.
So, as I said before, once you, you know, the military move you around, a lot of time when you retired, and most of the time, you were retired when you spent most of your time, you know, during the time you was in service. So I couldn't see taking my kids back to Baltimore, trying to raise them in a large city. And at that time, Baltimore was the eighth largest city in the country in 1968. So I couldn't see taking them back, and I decided on a small town. Got to know a lot of people here during that time. I was, you know, in and out with my family. I built a home here in 68. Went to work for the Job Corps, and I worked for them for 23 years.
What's your wife's name?
Willie, W-I-L-L-I.
Okay, and when did you, what year did you all get married?
1953.
And do you, how many girls, you just have three girls? Okay. Now, when you got your orders to come to Kentucky, what was the first thing that popped in your head about coming to a state?
Well, the only thing first thing I thought about was the resources, you know. And the distilleries and some of the, you know, some of the famous things, you know. I remember going through here back before I went overseas and on the train, and that was in Louisville. And so really, I didn't know too terribly much about Kentucky, no more than some of the things that I had read, you know, physically visited the state.
What about as far as race relations were handled, because Kentucky is considered the South? Did that ever pop into your head?
Well, you know, before during that time, no, really it didn't, because when you're in the military, you didn't think too much about, you know, segregation and things, so because you had other things on your mind. You had, you had the military on your mind. And, but I can say one thing. Back in 1948, I don't know what y'all remember now, but Truman integrated the military.
Mm-hmm.
Where he passed out, you know, orders to integrate the military. that time I was already in Japan. And so I was a guinea pig. They used me in an all-white unit. They picked some of the best soldiers they thought could make it in an all-white unit. And vice versa, they did the same thing. They put, whites and black units. So I was the only black person in 1940 in an all-white unit for about 9 or 10 months. So that was my first experience with being involved in integration.
Was it difficult? Did they play pranks on you?
I was always, it didn't take me long to get used to things. I mean, I thought about it. I started saying no at one time, when they first asked me. So I said, no, I go ahead and try it. Maybe they help some of my people,
Right.
And so I really enjoyed it. And in fact, I made received another promotion while I was in there.
Oh.
Yeah.
And this was while you were in Japan, right?
In Japan, so on the occupation.
Okay. All right. Now I'm going to ask you some things about your education. Now, you're from Baltimore, Maryland, so you're a city boy.
Yeah.
So how were the city schools set up?
Well, city schools, back during those days, as you know, they were all segregated schools. And most, larger cities. And I think the same way in Hamilton, too, from what I learned, I forgot here. And now they had some whites, blacks going to white schools in smaller areas, like, in counties in Maryland, but definitely out in the city. And it was all white school, all black.
What were the differences between the white schools and the black schools that you saw as a student?
Well, one of the things was we received a lot of hand-me-down material. Books, they just thought, I don't know, Ms. Johnson probably knew about this. And that's one of the things that I disliked. And I used to voice my opinion on that, back during, that had been many years ago when I was in school. And of course, I graduated in 1947, already, over 50 years ago. And and I understand some of these things went on, in other schools too. Now we did have top-rate teachers. The black teachers were great back during that day. And I think blacks learned more under black teachers than they did right now too, I think, than they did on the white teachers. Because they made sure you got it.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't turn you loose and tell you they thought you had it. If they had to work overtime.
So when you graduated high school, you went right into the military?
No, for a while. I went to junior college in Baltimore for about a year. And I couldn't decide what I wanted to do because my mind was still mixed up. My father died when I was 14 years old. And he was only 34. This was in 44.
How did he die?
Well, he had a tumor in the brain. And he left 7 kids, and I was the oldest one. The baby was 13 months old. And I had to help my mother raise those kids. I'm not bragging, but I thought I did the best that I, could during that time. I worked full-time jobs while I was still going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 years, I never received over 6 hours of sleep at night, because I had to come in and study. I wouldn't let this work and interfere with my school at that time. Mother begged me not to. She didn't want me to work. But I said, well, I'm going to have to help you. I said, I promised Dad that I would. He talked to me about 3 hours before he passed. And he asked me to help raise the kids. I said, keep the family together. And I stuck with him. And I think about it often. And at that time, my mother was young. She was only 32. So today's standard, she would still been on a young girl, at 32 years old. So she almost lost her mind during that time, and but she bounced back out of it. But with the help of my two grandmothers, we made it. And then my mother, she finally, came out of it. It was an emotional thing for her. Lose her husband, 7 kids like that.
Where, how did your mother make a living? What did she do? What was her job?
Well, she couldn't work at that time. So it was a little different. Social Security, like during that time. My father, because he had worked at the post office for several years. So he left us in, fairly good shape. And with me working full-time job and everything, my brother that was next to me, he finally found him a good job. So we survived.
What was your job?
Well, one of my jobs, I worked at the post office part-time, person at the post office. At that time, they were hiring you 16 years old now, but now they don't. And once I worked at a naval base, which is Bainbridge Naval Base in Baltimore, and I worked in the commissary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool. So why did you decide to go into the military?
Well, a lot of my friends were going in during that time, and I figured, like I said, I couldn't decide what I wanted to do, what degree area I wanted to go into when I was in junior college. So I said, well, I just go ahead and try the military. But at that time, we heard a lot that the military would help you with your education and everything. And they did. I received, during the 20 years that I was in service, 21 years of service, every chance I had, I picked up what education I could, in the local college. Mm-hmm.
Now, what's your occupation today?
My occupation now?
Mm-hmm.
I'm retired.
All right.
Well, in 1968, when I retired, they asked me to come to work down at Job Corps. And y'all familiar with Job Corps?
Mm-hmm.
And they used to, try to hire ex-military people if possible, because they felt that we were able to, to handle, young kids, from the experience in the military. So I went to work for them. And I worked for 23 and a half, my last 15 years. I was manager of the, they called it the disciplinary department, but actually it's the standards department that handled the, it's the court system of Job Corps over here. And out of 112 settlers during that time, Earl C. Clement was the largest. So we were the flagship of all Job Corps. And at one time, I was on loan to the regional office, going around, investigating the Justice Department, Justice section of other Job Corps, because we were the flagship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And during the time I was in the military, I received a lot of experience in the justice portion of life, because I was studying on courts in the military. I was worked for the provost marshal's office at one time in the military, and I was military police for a while, so I had a lot of experience in that. So I didn't have a problem, getting into the area that I did at the Job Corps. And then I retired in 1968. I could have gone to corporate office, which was an all-black corporation that at that time handled the day-to-day operation of Job Corps. And that was Minot in Jackson, Mississippi. They wanted me to come, but I didn't want to pull up stakes now. The state.
People kind of come to Henderson, stay here. They don't ever go away. Okay.
I met a lot of people here. Johnson back during that time. I was still in the military there. She knew my family and my wife, her sisters, and their families and everything. So then I got involved with church activities when I was in the military over in North Chapel. I think you visited the church very much when you said to me. And so I said, well, I might as well just stay before I go back to Baltimore. But during that time, a lot of my friends, they left town. And someone was dead.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated, I guess, with something like about 115. And I think half of it, for the last reunion I went to, the 40th reunion, I think that was in 87. And we still looking at the list of deceased people, you know. I said, and I'm still here.
Now, when you went to school in Baltimore, how did you get there? Did you walk or did you ride a bus?
Bus, walk. Most of your schools, you know, pretty close in America. At that time, I think, 6 black high schools in Baltimore.
Oh, wow. So how many people were in your school altogether? Can you remember?
Not right off hand now. That's one of those things that my heart and arteries kick in. Well, they were large high schools, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know the total number now.
Now, when you were in Henderson, when did you move to Henderson permanently?
After I retired.
Okay, so 1968. Okay, got it.
I built a home.
Where did you build your home?
On the corner of South England and Martin Luther King.
Now, how did you decide on that lot to build your home?
Well, see, I had already owned a piece of property on that corner anyway when I was in service. But once I was overseas, I couldn't take my wife with me, so we bought a house right on that corner where I am now.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I came back from overseas, she went with traveled with me to Fort Knox, where I spent about 3 years. And so
I'm from Radcliffe.
Yeah, I think I remember you telling me
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
So I rented my house out for several years. Mm-hmm. And then when I got out, I couldn't find a piece of property like I wanted. And I went out to some of the subdivision. After found out I was black, where they want to jack up the price and everything on property, you know. And I could have built, you know, early, but I didn't want to, you know, just give away money. Mm-hmm. The money, it came too hard, you know. So I decided to build right on the house that I owned, the lot that I had. I had that house torn down. I hated to because I had a lot of money in it. And so I built that home. We've been there for 32 years now. And it's a tri-level. Look almost good as this one right here.
Now, when you came to Henderson, it was during the 60s, the end of the 60s, so that was a hot spot time as far as civil rights goes. So how do you think this town accepted immigration and the new legislation that was coming about?
Well, I think they did pretty well on their set because most of these small towns, you just don't have a lot of problems like, you know, big cities, you know. And but I think it went quietly, but then again, you in Henderson, you got a lot of this underlying stuff, you know, people that underlying segregationists, but they're not loud with it, anything. And I think over the year, things have improved in Henderson quite a bit. And in fact, I've seen a lot of improvement here. But the only thing that's slow is the blacks moving up into position and things. But this began to happen now, you know. But we have a black postmistress here, and she's been here just a couple months now. And Ms. Johnson was the first one that ran for the school board. And she spent several years on that board, and I think she chaired it for two terms, I believe. Four years on the board. And you chaired it off.
She was on it for eight years
and 4 years chair. Okay, there we go. And we also, I knew I supported her during that time, you know, I used to attend meetings and things, you know. And I don't know if anybody else attempted to run for that board, Ms. Johnson's, but I know Ms. I think several have run, and when we got run, let's run it right now.
You said things are improving. How do you see race relations in Henderson in the future?
In the future? I think race relations, and I think Henderson will be, eventually will be a model for race relations.
Oh, really? Why do you think it's going to be a model?
Because, like I said, begin to see blacks, you know, move into position now. And we have a lady that's running for the school board now, and she's doing well. We had a black on the city commission there, and he went off because of some things that were going on during that time between the you know, the city commission. He got tied in with that thing, you know, as a supporter to some of the people that were already on the commission. And but our biggest problem here right now is blacks not proud of some blacks not wanting to, you know, to move up. And you know, a lot of black folks, I guess, crisis-oriented people, mm-hmm. and a lot of times they don't want to do anything unless something is happening, something big is going on. You know? But I think we will eventually, become a model city, you know, for integration.
What do you say to people who, a lot of young people I hear talking like this, that segregation is okay because we're just too different to be around each other? What do you say to people who think that?
I don't know. I think we was all put on the earth to live together for one thing. And I can't see, you know, it'll become a problem if we continue, you know, to be separate.
What kind of problems do you think can arise? If we live separately.
If we live separately, well, one thing would be no advancement for where we slow down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now we're going to skip to your religious beliefs. Do you go to church regularly? Where do you go to church?
North Chapel.
That's right. And how long have you been a member?
Well, I became a full-time member when I was retired in 1968, but I started there when I first came to Henderson. In fact, me and my wife got married in that church in 1953.
That's a long time to be married. How important is church in your life?
It's very important. We were all, my mother, hardcore Baptist.
Hardcore Baptist.
My father was Methodist, but I guess she was stronger than he was, so we all end up, you know, as Methodists, all seven of us.
So it was something that you grew up with?
Yeah, okay. I'm strong about, you know, the Methodist denomination.
Okay. And aren't you a deacon, too?
No.
Oh, I thought you were a deacon.
I probably could have been, but, you know, I just feel that everyone's not just really cut out to be a deacon.
Right.
And I had my ideas about digging in that particular church. I was asked by every pastor that's been there since the one that married us, I guess. And but I've been on trustee board for many years. And in fact, I've been chairing the board for the last 6 years. And I work very closely with the digging.
Now, let's talk about the NAACP. When did you become a member here at Henderson?
When I retired in 1968.
Okay. And eventually, what offices did you hold in the group?
Well, when I first became a member of the branch, the Reverend Anthony Brooks, Dr. Brooks, mm-hmm. his name, he was brother there. And he was involved in a lot of things, teaching school, and, pastored two churches at that time, one in Henderson, one in Edwardsville. And so right after immediately after John, I became the vice president. And this was in 1971. And eventually, I became the vice president in 69.
Okay.
I can take that back. And I took over the branch as president in 1971.
How long were you president?
Still is.
Boy, married forever,
longest,
president
longest
forever.
Longest one in the office in the state of Kentucky.
Why do you participate in that group? Why is it a good experience for you?
I feel...
you must like it.
Well, one thing is I think the NAACP is needed across the country and around the world, too, to help a lot of people. And, so I felt that I should have been having a hard time getting somebody else to run the brand. So I'm going to hold on until somebody else take over. And because if the branch goes down, they will take the charter away. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard time to, you know, receive charters now. And it's hard to get a charter back once they take it away from you.
Mm-hmm. How many members are there?
Well, we've got about 60 now, I think. At one time, we had well over 100. And we have something like 12 or 13 life members. Mm-hmm. And we only have one golden herders member.
That's what I'm talking about. Miss John.
Yeah. Only one. I've been trying to get others, you know. And I think eventually I'll be, I'm a life member. I've been a life member for, I guess, about 25 years. Start on my golden herder before I get called home.
Tell me about what happened at the pool.
At the pool? Okay, the pool deal.
When was that?
They tore down the all-black pool. They didn't want to put any money out on it. And we decided to, and then at the same time, they were slow in accepting blacks all-white pool, which is on the north end of town. And they had another white pool here at that time, too, which was the Pope pool. And I think they were in the process of tearing that one down because it wasn't in real good shape. Mm-hmm. So that would leave just one, the Agassiz pool. And so a bunch got together one time and said, I think it was the last day of swimming for that particular year. I only forgot what year it was now. And they decided to walk. And I had been out of town when I came back, and I heard they were getting ready to march, you know. And somebody called me. I think it was the police chief called me. And asked me would I go march. No, just drive by and ride around and make sure they stay in, you know, peaceful, you know. So I said, okay. So after I drove down there, I parked my car because they were meeting in town. I parked my car. I said, well, I might as well just go walk with them. And they went down and they jumped in the pool. And I think they haven't had any problems since. And there was a police car riding along beside us, you know. And I kept hearing my name over the radio, mm-hmm. you know. So I guess they were discussing me at the time. But we did it peacefully, and I'm glad that I got back in town, you know, in time before this dark. Cause we had some kids here then. They didn't take too much.
Mm-hmm. Now, how were the police in Henderson? They were pretty cooperative and nice about it, calling you and letting you know what was going on.
Yeah, they pretty. I have a pretty good rapport with my brother police chief and some of the passers too that I've had. Had a few problems with, you know, but they understood me and I understood them. And we've had black policemen here too over the years, but they don't stay because they go where the money is. Mm-hmm. We only have one black policeman on force right now. And at one time, we had four on at one time, but they will leave and go where the money is. Mm-hmm. And we had one to even make sergeant on the force, and he quit and went somewhere.
Now, I can't imagine not being able to swim in the pool with somebody else because of just color. Do you think that young people, even younger than me today, in schools, are being taught what happened and how things were? Or do you think history is just kind of, the civil rights movement is a paragraph and then they keep on going and study Roman history? What do you think?
Well, I think if they leave the kids alone, if the grown-ups would leave the kids alone, these diehards, I think they would eventually, because I notice now how black and white kids, you know, how they socialize and get along in school and everything. And I see them getting along, you know, much better than they did during my days when I was coming along. But I think it's the old diehards will leave the segregationists, will leave the young people alone. I think they just mellow in place, you know.
What about other demonstrations that went on in Henderson? That were there sit-ins and different things here too?
Yeah, I think at one time I marched when I first joined the NAACP. The young people walked down and on City Hall once. They was asking for something. I don't even recall what it was now. And so they marched on City Hall. At that time, Reverend Brooks was still the president. I was the vice president. And I come in from work that evening, and I just joined them. We walked from the inner black neighborhood down to the city building. And whatever they was asking for, they were successful in it.
So it seems like Henderson government was pretty much okay.
Yeah.
They see you all coming. They're like, all right, we'll just, okay. So did you? What did you think about your all's experience compared to things that you saw on TV that were going on in, you know, Alabama and Mississippi where people were getting pretty much beaten and bombed? And
yeah, at that time I didn't know too much about the activities in Henderson at that time. I was doing the turbulent 60s, about the mid-60s.
And you were in Japan, in the hospital.
They were in the 60s. I was here in the States then.
Oh, were you?
And in fact, we was on, they put us on alert. I was stationed in Fort Stewart, Georgia at one time. And they put us on alert for some of the things that was going on in the state of Georgia and also in Alabama. In fact, we flew to Alabama once. And they had us on the dirt, and we was had us out at a hangar at one of the airports, Air Force bases in Alabama.
About how he was on call in Georgia and Alabama during the turbulent 60s. Okay. So you all were on call waiting in a hangar in case something happened.
Right. That was on one of the incidents in Alabama.
Now, what did the military teach you as far as integration goes? Because you were the first black in an all-white unit.
Yeah.
Now, were you scared?
No. I never was afraid of the military. It didn't bother me too much. I mean, it wasn't that easy when we first got started, but I never was afraid. I've already been, always been strong about things, always hope for the best and everything.
Now, when you walked in and you brought your stuff into wherever the units were staying or barracks or however you all were set up, what did people say to you, or did anybody speak to you?
They treated me like king.
So they thought you were pretty cool, huh?
I guess so. If you called it cool,
what would be the word back then? Groovy? No, that was 60s.
Another thing that went on in Henderson too, back when they integrated schools here, and this was in 1975, we were down to one teacher in the classroom. Ms. Johnson, remember that? Down to one teacher. So, on one of my trips to Baltimore to visit my family in 75, I drove up to Washington try to think what office I went to and reported what was going on here. But anyway, I'll think about it eventually. Anyway, they sent investigators here from the regional office out of Atlanta. And they sent a black guy. And the investigator, and he stayed here 3 days. And during this time here, he interviewed teachers, interviewed kids. And when he left, he made his report out and everything. During that the next term, we end up with 12 teachers in the classroom. And the term after that, I think, was up to about 20, I believe.
20 black teachers? Mm-hmm. Okay.
The teachers, so, yeah.
And this was in 1975?
In 75.
What made you go to Washington?
Because I got tired of what was going on here. Well, it wasn't far from it anyway, from home, Baltimore, they're 30 miles.
Mm-hmm.
I just drove on over to. Well, I'm trying to think where I went, what off something too.
It's those arteries.
What's that?
It's your arteries. Now that took guts. That really did. And it, so by 3 or 4 years later, you had 20 black teachers in the school system? Okay. Right. And this is in Henderson County?
In Henderson, well, so Henderson County is the school system.
Yeah.
Marys County.
Okay. Why do you think it's important for the school system to have black teachers?
Well, I think it should be a mixture. That way the kids get used to seeing black and white. I think it's just the right thing to do.
Okay. What do you think about today's education system? Do you think that we need more minority teachers?
Yeah, I think we need more because a lot of our minorities teachers are going to where the money is, I guess, and we just don't have as many in the classroom, you know, in the education field that we did, you know, 7 years ago. You have more things now that industry, you know, young people when they go to school now rather than just teaching. Mm-hmm. Most of them go where the money is now.
Now, when your daughters ask you about the civil rights movements and things that you did, what kind of stories do you tell them?
Well, I just tell them, you know, what actually happened.
Do you think young people know what happened?
Yeah, I think most of us are from history and history books and from stories. So I think they're pretty well educated on what, you know, they might not understand the full force of it, though, but I think they understand what they know.
How do you think the role of the NAACP has changed from then until today in Henderson?
Well, I think the role from the early days to the present day, I think we have a different the role now, you know, in the NAACP. And it's not like, you know, during the turbulent days when the NAACP was out there, you know, fighting along with everybody else. It's more of a education points now. Mm-hmm. I wish I had brought, I had a paper that I had that I could have explained everything exactly what the NAACP is doing right now.
So it's more of an educational emphasis now? Do you think the civil rights movement?
Because, you know, we don't even have as many complaints like
right.
You know, like we used to. I know I just finished up one out at Alcade with the black employees out there had a problem. You know, with the leadership. You know, out of that plant, and we worked with them for about 4 or 5 months and got things, you know, ironed out. And along with their attorney, which is based in Ohio. And we did that without a whole lot of publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people didn't even know it. We had some of the big officials, the plant manager, the people over the from personnel. I mean, just a big wheel met with us at 7th Street Baptist Church one Saturday. I mean, they just took off and came. And yeah, all the blacks there, the one that's in position out in the arcade, that we handle that under the table without, you know, a whole lot of publicity. But the black employees, they were, you know, really satisfied on how the thing came out. And they really did have a lot of complaints about the way they were treated.
Mm-hmm. So you're an advocate for people too, the NAACP. Okay. And how long do you plan on remaining president?
As soon as I'm out of ticket, I'm going to start working real soon because I'm not as young as I used to be. And once you get that 3 scores and 10, I think it's time to slow down. I've been retired for 10 years, but I stay busy with these organizations. I'm on the Beaver Girl Development.
Mm-hmm.
And that which has, you know, things for the Southern County area. I'm on the executive board for them, and also the executive board for the Ottoman area.
Mm-hmm. The Ottoman area.
I just come off of the chamber. I was on there. I was on the chamber for, I guess, for five years.
Mm-hmm. Why are you so involved?
Well, anything I can do to help somebody. And another thing, it keeps me from, becoming relaxed. And I think that's one of the problems. People retire and then sit down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have very few medical problems right now, and I think that's a big help to me by being involved. I exercise a lot, too. But I guess I just got accustomed to helping people, and not only just I would say civil rights for you and other areas. I do a lot of personal things for people to help them out. Yeah, I don't like to sit down. I get up early every morning.
Me neither. I'm nervous. That's why.
Out of the bed at 5:30, no later than 5:30 every morning.
Now, have you ever faced any kind of racism as far as stores in Henderson or police officers in Henderson throughout your years here?
Well, when I first took over the NAACP, I had a lot of police used to follow me all the time. And so I got mad one day and I stopped and asked one policeman why he was following me. He said, well, I wouldn't follow the car in front of you. I said, well, you wasn't behind the one in front of me, you was behind me. I said, you followed me for about 6 or 8 blocks. And I got mad then. I left and went straight to the police office. I forgot who the chief was doing at that time. And his receptionist said, I went and asked for him. She said, well, he's not in. And I could look right where he was sitting. She just, her door was cracked and she didn't know him. So I just went around her desk and went on the correct street. And he said, oh, how you misclassified? I said, I want to tell you something, chief. I said, I'm not doing anything that, you know, not breaking no laws or anything. And I want you police to stay off my tail. If you don't, y'all gonna hear from me. So I never had no more trouble.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then once up at Walmart, several years ago, I was Habitat for a long time too. And they had me in charge of a car that we were raffling off at the time, you know. So I pulled my car up to take some things in my private car, to take some things out to put in the raffle car. I forgot what it was now. And so a policeman drove by where I was parked. There was no parking zone. But I was right there in the car, you know, so they had this little young policeman on. He come out, he said, where are you no parking zone? I said, I can see that. I said, this raffle car is too. I said, what you gonna do with that? But we had gotten permission from Walmart to park it there, you know. And he said, well, I'm gonna have to write you up. I said, go ahead. He said, well, supposed to fire trucks or something, you know, come up, emergency or ambulance or something. I said, if I see them coming, I'll just move my car. And so he wrote me up anyway. They say he had a history of writing up people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day I took the ticket down to him and I explained to Ed. You know, Ed Brady was that. Our brother chief was on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I explained to him, he just took the ticket and just tore it up. You know? So they do little things like that sometimes to try to aggravate, you know.
What do you think about all this? Right now, because it's an election year, everybody's talking about racial profiling. What do you think about that?
I think we have a little of it here, but it's not that big. I get a lot of reports on it. But once I get a report on somebody, you know, think they're being, you know, involved with racial profiling,
mm-hmm.
what I do, I will direct this person directly to the police chief. Like I said, we have a pretty good report. And, send them directly to him, and I've gone with, you know, to a certain, you know, certain people to the police chief. And I think they pretty well get on with that. We haven't had a big problem yet in Henderson profile. Because one thing, everybody in Henderson know everybody. Most of the people know the policemen. I see policemen stopping all up and down the street, guys talking to them. And some of the young people, I think some of the young people, they got picked a pretty good rapport. But we do get some complaints with it.
If there's anything you could change about Henderson, what would it be?
Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to see in Henderson. More black businessmen. And that's one of the problems we've had, you know, over the years. Just about all the black businessmen, like, it's been wiped out. I would like, I definitely would like to see.
How they been wiped out? Families just moved, or
they just moved, and people not interested in, you know, in business, I guess. And other than a barber shop or a beauty shop here and there, but we do have a young man here that has an insurance agency. He's doing real well.
There's a funeral home too, isn't there?
Well, it was.
Oh,
and they went by the wayside. Died at all in Fieldhorn. Another one tried to take over from Evansville, but the business wasn't that good, so they closed completely. But we do have a film home in Evansville, which is Mason, who take care of most of the black men.
Do you think you...
Oh, yeah, they have one, I guess they call that... they don't do the business yet. They just use it as a chapel, I think. Mason chapel.
Do you think you made the right decision to raise your children here?
I think I did. Rather than go to Baltimore, I know I did.
See, my father's from Chicago, and he made the same
Well, you know
decision.
About big city life, too.
Well, I was at, he raised us in Radcliffe after he retired. He was in for 30 years.
That right.
So, is there any...
You still live in the Radcliffe area?
Well, I'm in Bowling Green now going to school, but...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think he was telling... They came here during that time,
yeah.
too. I think
yeah.
I met them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That little crazy man always eating. That's my father. Now, is there anything else that you would like to add that you don't think I covered?
But I don't think so.
Okay.
Other question you want to ask me?
Well, I think we got it all. Oh, wait, what are your parents' names?
My parents? Oh, they were, my father was Robert Meadplatt.
And your mother?
My mother was Mary Elizabeth.
Mary Elizabeth, okay. And I want to make sure I got your... August 29th, 1929 is your birthday? All right, good to go. Thank you so much.
That's a long time to go with.
Yeah.